This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 122, brought to you in association with Smart Pension. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Christoph Gugelmann, CEO and co-founder of TradeTech, to discuss creating a marketplace for the $9 trillion per annum trade finance market. I often preamble, if indeed preamble is a verb, if it isn't, I've just made it one. I often preamble with macro trends, which FS has seen for decades. In both the last episode on litigation crowdfunding and in this one on trade finance marketplaces, the macro trend is enabling investors to invest in assets in categories which were uninvestable in the past. This time, it's allowing investment organizations to invest in trade finance, which historically was only provided by the banks and uninvestable. Making previously obscure or closed asset classes into an asset has two benefits. First, it enables new pools of capital to access markets, thereby lowering the cost of funding to the benefits of those last time needing litigation or this time offering trade finance. The second flip side benefit, on the other side of the coin, is that investors, again whether private or corporate, can gain exposure to a new asset class, promising potentially higher returns, as well as returns non-correlated to the old school asset classes of bonds and equities. Non-correlation, of course, leading to a better diversified portfolio with lower volatility. We last dived into the super important market of trade finance a couple of years ago in LFP 081 with Guy Willens from Trade River, who was talking about what it takes to digitize a very old school transaction type. And by very old school, I mean very old school. I was actually recently writing about trade in old Assyria, about 2000 to 1800 BC. Amazingly enough, fun fact of the day, we know more about how trade was organized in old Assyria than we do in ancient Greece, ancient Rome, or any period until about 1000 AD. TradeTech are going one step further than merely facilitating a more 21st century approach to trade finance rather than 2000 BC approach, and are creating a marketplace for originators and investors. It is not impossible to imagine your pension fund of the future not as just cash, bonds and equity, but as, for example, cash, bonds, equity, litigation and trade finance. Why not? Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Christoph. Thanks for joining me today.
Hello, Mike. Thanks for having me.
So, for reasons which may become apparent, you were telling me that you're very cognizant that today is very important in the Chinese calendar.
It is. Happy New Year's, Mike.
And I believe it's the year of the pig, actually.
Absolutely, it is. And with some significant portion of the team based in Asia, it is slightly more quiet here than usually.
And you asked me not to quiz you any further on Chinese horoscopes and being the European, and I promised not to, but I thought it's really important that you learn early in the podcast that you can't trust a thing that I say. So presumably you don't want to talk about the significance of the pig, although actually my Jamjong master, cut a long story short, Taoist practices and all that, is actually a feng shui master, and my sign is pig, actually. So I've got a little pig on my desk, which apparently is supposed to be very good feng shui for me. So hello to all those who are Year of the Pig. Although I didn't quite know why pig is good for me, because actually I'm a water tiger. But anyway, so in terms of your Asian parts of your business, how's that organized then? We're in Bishopsgate, which is not particularly Asian, and the weather certainly isn't.
Yeah, we have been growing very quickly, and we have now two teams which are Vietnam-based, which provide us development work. They're fully dedicated trade tech teams. And also we have an office in Singapore, which is helping us on the business development side.
Interesting, isn't it? It's very global. And last time we stayed in Singapore, we stayed at, I think, the Mandarin Oriental, and we had a room looking over the harbour, and you've got all of these ships just lined up and lined up and lined up. It was phenomenal. You can actually sort of see the flow, literally the flow of trade. I think at the time there were so many ships there because this trade was a bit low. And as I was mentioning the New Year special, or another one recently, we were in Hanoi last autumn. At the same time, a friend of mine who was in the tech business was in Ho Chi Minh City and apparently was going to some London pub or something in an area that looked just like Canary Wharf. So the whole world's getting the same. So how come you've got the Vietnamese development team? Did you one day think, I need a development team, why don't I have one in Vietnam?
No, we have been screening basically the market for cheaper development capacity. And of course, we have been looking for talent. There was an opportunity which came across. It was basically a team which worked with one of our seed investors previously. And that's how the opportunity came about.
And just as a sort of rough benchmark, because there have been quite a few people on the show, given the shortage of developers in London that are looking to near offshore, say, for example, Ukraine or Belarus, we had on the show, or further offshore, obviously India and Vietnam. Are you seeing over time a tendency for salaries to level up and equate around the world? Or can you still, for example, get an order of magnitude advantage by far offshoring your business? Or is it just a factor of two or three these days?
I think salaries will probably level off at some point. I think we have been seeing this in markets like India, where, of course, IT development capacity was extremely cheap. That's not so much the case anymore. So the world is definitely catching up and talent flows much more easily these days.
Yes, indeed. And we forgot to establish the fact, as I normally try and do, that you're a human being, but maybe people listening can assume you're a human being. And we were talking just before, human beings are very strange. I mean, we're talking about different parts of the world. And I remember, I think it was Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Well, there's a little bit where he talks about people at point C, which is between point A and point B, wondering what's so good about point B that everyone goes from point A to point B. But at the same time, what's so good about point A? Because everyone goes from point B to point A. And you were saying that your origins are in Switzerland, and I was saying that my distant origins are in Switzerland, and I quite like to go to Switzerland because it's a sensible country. But you've clearly come the opposite direction. So what possessed you to go from what appears to me to be a very sensible and civilized country to somewhere which is very grey, damp, and not without its challenges these days?
Well, work has brought me here more than 20 years ago, and my family essentially have been raised completely here, so I'm very much attached to the United Kingdom personally. But I started like many Swiss blokes do. I started in banking. I started in investment banks.
I thought you were about to say with cows or something like that.
Cows would have been the other alternative, clearly. So I spent most of my life working for Goldman Sachs and other large investment banks thereafter. And I basically have become fascinated over time, after about two decades in banking, with real assets. I have done a lot in derivative space, and derivative space is a fascinating place. But I think, you know, having a connect to the real world is something I was really tried to establish. And trade finance and commodity in particular was what fascinated me when I left my last job in the banking industry, and I joined a Swiss-based commodity trading firm in 2012, and realized that trade finance actually is very difficult to place with institutional investors. It's not an investable asset class. And initially couldn't really, you know, figure out where the points exactly were, and it wasn't easy to articulate. But over time it became clearer and clearer, and as a consequence, myself and my co-founder Niels Behling, we started an asset management company which was arranging and investing in trade finance. And through this, we started to more and more realize that technology is the only enabler. And I guess we will kind of go a little bit more in details afterwards why this is the case.
Right. It's interesting what you say about derivatives, because when I joined the city many years ago, a story I've told before, I vividly remember a piece of research from Salomons explaining what an interest rate swap was. And there were two boxes, and a fix went one way and floating went the other way. And because no one had seen these things before, you know, people spent a sort of day or so trying to understand this and wondering how on earth you would price it and all that kind of stuff. So it's literally within one person's career that this sort of whole thing has taken off, as it has. And of course, it went through the kind of degrees of, there's no limit really. So you end up with sort of CDO squared divided by something, and, you know, yard, 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 and all that kind of stuff. But I do wonder then, from what you're saying, whether that's kind of peaked out, and, you know, every silly derivative that can possibly be done, lots of them which turned out to be a bit sort of rather more toxic and that kind of stuff. And actually, therefore, that market itself is, it's kind of nothing new. It's not something that you go into to do something new and hot and sexy. Whereas ironically, it's not ironically, actually, if you understand the tech world, because quite often innovation needs most to take place in the unsexiest things. I mean, I don't know, for example, facilities management in a building like this, we're in yet another WeWork. They've got sort of, there's mechanical things behind these doors and loos and water and electricity and all that kind of thing. Infrastructure, which, as I say, like the trade finance, has been around for at least 4,000 years and forever. That kind of stuff has somehow sort of missed out compared to the clever clogs things you can do with abstract numbers and spreadsheets and calculations and all this kind of very platonic thing, which isn't really real in some sense.
I think that is a fair point. And if you look at all the markets which have developed, and I guess the two of us have seen many markets develop in our lifetime, interest rate derivative market essentially moved into the credit derivative market, mortgage-backed securities have been developed. You can purchase literally any product out there in a liquid form. The only thing, the only bank product you cannot access is arguably the oldest bank product, which is trade finance.
Yes, the only one that other springs to mind, and I don't know, but we haven't done it on the podcast, is project finance. I don't know whether project finance are going back to old Klein Watts. We financed the project finance team, the Projectiles, financed the Dartford River Crossing tunnel and bridge, which, as I recall, a million years ago was supposed to be free to people by now, but somehow they keep charging people, which is a little bit naughty. Anyway, in terms of trade finance, we've covered it on the show before. So very briefly, roughly speaking, I remember that trade finance is something like financing the buyer of a bunch of assets. If I want to buy 1,000 mobile phones from China, do I get the trade finance?
Yeah, so look, I think any goods sold and any services provided require, of course, a seller and a buyer, as you pointed out. And many of those, of course, require financing. So let's make an example. A seller exports goods into another country. He basically grants and has to grant the buyer some payment terms. So now the buyer essentially pays maybe in 60 days, right? That's his legal rights after he receives the goods. So this time between the seller shipping off the goods and the buyer actually physically paying is essentially working capital somebody has to provide. And it's often difficult for the seller to do this. Of course, you know, the buyer is not going to be willing to pay earlier. And a third party, and these have been so far largely banks, are essentially providing this financing.
Okay, so I do remember in the dim and distant past of my memory, which gets everything mixed up, that there is this thing called, it's not quite called it, but let's use simple terms, buyer finance and seller finance. That in some circumstances, the buyer needs finance. In other circumstances, the seller needs finance, while the sort of goods sit on a cargo ship and putt all the way around the world. So is trade finance covering both buyer finance and seller finance?
Yeah, so there's three big categories of trade finance. There is the documentary type of credit, which is a bank business, and I suggest to leave this aside for the moment. There is the so-called prepayment finance, which purely happens between buyers and sellers. It's literally you going and buy a book, you know, you kind of like prepay and then they ship it to you. So not interesting. So the open account financing has exactly what you just mentioned, has a few aspects. You can look at it from a buyer-centric perspective, or you look at it from a supplier-centric perspective. And a supplier-centric perspective essentially is you are servicing essentially the supplier or seller of goods, whereas buyer-centric, it's essentially the buyer. The instruments we're talking about is always essentially, you know, kind of based on the same underlying transaction. It just really depends who you service.
Right, okay. And then going back to ancient Assur, 4,000 years ago, a donkey caravan would set off from Assur to Kanesh, which was the largest colony of the Assyrian Empire in Turkey these days, and somebody would have to finance the goods when they're on those donkeys. And actually, the reason that we know so much about it is that a huge pile of clay tablets were found at Kanesh about 100 years ago, and more keep surfacing, but I mean it was literally tens of thousands of tablets. These tens of thousands of tablets are mostly contracts and trade finance contracts and partnership contracts and all that kind of stuff. And when Guy was on the show a couple of years ago, we don't need to go over this again, but he was saying that one thing is actually that trade finance, compared to many other things, has got lots of complex pieces of paper all over the place because it's sort of grown up around the world and there's pieces of paper here and pieces of paper there. So actually just digitizing it in the first place before we get to the marketplace is quite a challenge. It's not like, shall we say, for example, equity, where you've got Apple shares. There's a share in Apple. It's a simple thing. Well, historically, it was a piece of paper. Probably isn't a piece of paper now, but you know what I mean. Like, you could have one piece of paper. I have owned pieces of paper which were shares in companies. I think probably still got some for private companies. I have a piece of paper that is the share in the company. Trade finance, there isn't just one sheet of A4, is there? There's paper and things all over the place.
That's absolutely right. So there is some complexity, but arguably some unnecessary complexity, which literally just has developed over time. It starts with the lingo, meaning one institutional investor or one bank would basically talk about supply chain finance. The other one will talk about kind of like reverse factoring. Somebody else will talk about payables financing.
No wonder I'm confused on terminology.
You're probably already confused.
Yeah,
but it basically means all the same, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's the same the same words for, you know, or different words for the same fact. And that's completely unnecessary, and there have been many attempts to kind of harmonize it. I think to some degree, because it's all bank financed and banks have an interest to maintain, or had an interest to maintain, this asset class, there was actually no willingness to create some standard.
There was a disincentive to creating standards.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, so in terms of the standard, so moving on to what it takes to create a market, I was thinking randomly of Christmas presents. So the good thing about Christmas presents is that generally you can put them in a box and you wrap them up with a piece of paper and you give it to somebody and it's a thing inside the box. So last episode, talking about litigation crowdfunding, which, as Cormac was explaining, is a highly complex set of stuff in terms of, since the last podcast came out, I think they did their second one and it was sold in a matter of 9 hours, I think. And it was wrapped up in a box with a sort of very FSC name, but you'd understand it, and I'm sure most of the listeners would, as an ISA bond. So there was a box called ISA bond. Inside the ISA bond is stuff that if you bought it, you wouldn't need to understand, which is all little bits and pieces, all little pieces of paper, for the sake of argument, notionally speaking, is wrapped around. Now, once you can wrap, no matter how complex a transaction type, as it were, in a simple wrapper like a bond, or an equity, or an SPV, or you can stick it in an ISA, then that seems to me the first stage of actually being able to trade it on a market. Because otherwise, we're a bit like, we're not far here from Lloyd's insurance market, and you still see to this day people walking around with huge folders of pieces of paper and all that kind of stuff. So in terms of wrapping something, in terms of wrapping it up like a Christmas present in a sort of fungible fashion, how does that work with trade finance?
Yeah, and I think what you said, you know, before with the box is a fantastic analogy. If you think about what trade has achieved over the last, you know, 100 years or so, was the biggest achievement was the so-called intermodal container. It's essentially an ISO certified container, which now creates the ability to move goods easily around, so it's easy loading and unloading from ships to trains to trucks. Nothing like this has happened on the trade finance side, and it's absolutely overdue. We do have all the technologies for it. We basically apply repackaging and securitization in the trillions. In fact, there's about an 8+ trillion outstanding securitization market for bank products currently, but nothing like this gets really done in trade finance. And this is one of the critical bits for a standard credit buyer, somebody who is not the expert in trade finance but would like to get access to this asset class, you know, that he has an easy wrapper, that he can use his normal kind of clearing channels like Euroclear or whatever he uses, and has security and safety, you know, in purchasing such an instrument.
Yes, I like the irony, which is, as you say, that cargo containers were created some time ago, and it really has lowered the cost of transportation around the world. Going back to being able to see from our hotel window the port at Singapore, you unload these same size. It doesn't matter whether there's wine, motorbikes, mobile phones. It goes on a lorry. It's a standard size. It drives off. And that has really lowered the cost of transportation around the world. But ironically, in the case of the trade finance, it hasn't. So let's just stick with the wrapper then, because it seems to me that there's two aspects. The first is it comes in a simple box, so it's recognisable. It's an equity, it's a bond or something. It's a bond, it clears through Euroclear. Somehow, I'm not saying you're doing this, but theoretically speaking, you could presumably turn trade finance into a bond. It would settle through Euroclear, and then anybody who buys and sells would do it in the usual fashion. So we create the box. The second thing we'll come on to is assessing the value of what's in the box, yes? Mm-hmm. So Cormac has created a litigation crowdfunding ISABLE bond, which means you or I could buy it and we go, oh, we've got a bond. That's nice, so at least we can buy it and we can sell it fairly easily. Then we come on to, once we finish the wrapper, the second question, which is, it's nice it's a bond, but is it any good? At which point you have to open the box and understand what's inside it. But sticking with the box bit, so what is TradeTech's approach to standardising the assets? So you say, oh, Mike, it's trade finance and it's wrapped up in a blue box, or it's wrapped up in a bond, or it's wrapped up in an equity.
So there were many attempts in the market to actually try and standardize the underlying instruments themselves. All of them really failed. And the reason why they failed is a lot of these instruments are very short dated, very granular, very small. So example, you know, you have an invoice of £13.55 pence, you know, kind of matures in 39 days. It's not worthwhile, really, to buy this through a Euroclear channel. It's too complicated. So how do I package maybe 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 instruments and access them easily? And what you need to do is, and that's essentially one of our core services we provide is a securitization as a service. So you are essentially telling us what you want to buy, and through a workflow management system, you will be able to ongoingly, you know, kind of like make your money work concretely. You give me an amount of X, that amount of X will reside within an SPV.
Special purpose vehicle, which is a company set up for the special purposes.
Absolutely.
And it only does one thing, which is the standard vehicle used for many, many securitizations, as you explained before.
Absolutely. And you will get a note. That note can be now made visible on Bloomberg. You will have an ISIN number, which is kind of an identification number. And now what happens with your money in this box, basically, or in this special purpose company, is it will rotate on an automated basis based on how you instruct the company to make it work. That means at all times you will have the type of underlying trade finance instruments which you actually want to possess, and there is an automation such that, you know, in my previous example, after 39 days this little tiny receivable, once it's essentially matures, it will be replenished.
So just to take a practical example for anybody that wasn't quite following. So let's say, for the sake of argument, I'm a buyer and I say I've got £10 million. I'd really like to invest it in trade finance. That would be nice. Can you do it, please? You've got securitization as a service. So what, you take my 10 million and say, thank you very much, Mike, we'll make it happen somehow?
No, what you will have to do first, you will have to connect with an originator or a trade finance seller. These are large banks, and we're working with the largest banks.
How many banks are you working with at the moment?
So we have 8 banks which are deeply engaged, either in terms of production, POCs meaning proof of concepts, or in the process of onboarding. And the goal for all of these institutions is to sell trade finance in large scale, once we established, you know, market, in a very efficient format. So if you would have 10 million, you would essentially come to us. The network will provide you with access to buying opportunities. You would connect with Bank A. Bank A would agree with you on a certain kind of like portfolio composition, and would make sure that you would at all times essentially have a portfolio composition which suits you, you know, and which has been pre-agreed.
Okay, and then without diving into too much detail, would that be sectors such as, for example, I say for some crazy reason, I want to get involved in trade finance of mobile phones, or I want to get involved with trade finance of wine, or is it not actually categorized by the thing that's being traded? Is it some other abstract way? And how do people talk on your marketplace? Yeah. Somebody comes with money, what do they actually ask for? Do they ask for mobile phone trade, or wine trade, or motorbike trade? Or do they ask for trade from Japan to Vietnam? Or how is it sliced and diced?
Every instrument has essentially what we say attributes. Attribute could be the buyer country association, the supplier country association, which buyer does it has, which supplier does it has, what tenor does it has, what industry sector does it belong to. And you will be able, based on eligibility criteria, to tell us exactly what you want, and you would agree this with the selling bank. At the same time, you will be able to instruct so-called portfolio rules. Portfolio rules steering the composition of your portfolio. So you might want to have a certain set of diversification or granularity, and that means you will be able to set all these parameters.
So for example, to take that simple case, I mentioned Japan and Vietnam. A diversification might mean that I don't want more than a quarter of my portfolio in one trade route, shall we say. Because let's say Russia or China causes some fuss in the sea between Japan or the Kuril Islands or something like that, and suddenly there's no Japan and Vietnam trade at all, then my whole portfolio would be going down the plug hole, as opposed to, I want to actually have, at least for the sake of argument, 5 different trade routes, or 5 different asset categories, or 5 different types of buyer, or something like that.
That's exactly how it would work.
Just like portfolio management, actually, because it is a portfolio management.
It is a portfolio management, and it sounds funny and simple, since applied in every other as a clause, but banks think differently in terms of trade finance allocation. They think in terms of buyer or kind of like headroom, which they have. So at the beginning of the year, or of a client relationship, they would determine and say, I have 1 million of exposure, you know, which I can take. And then they just fill it up.
Basically, it's the old-fashioned approach to credit, which is the credit department will give you a line or a limit, and then you try and use that. It's a bit like the old-fashioned approach to budgeting, which still exists in large organisations, which you've got this year's budget. If you don't spend it on the 31st of December, it disappears, and you start all over again.
That's exactly right. And although it sounds simple, once you go into the nitty-gritties of such a highly granular and fast-moving, rotating asset class, technology becomes decisive. It's not like you and me buying a bond, which has a five-year maturity. I still know in 2 years' time that I have bought this bond. If you buy a trade finance exposure, you will very quickly lose control if you don't have precise mechanics.
Okay, so let's then come on to the, let's call it the risk and return and analysing the market. So we've established that we've got a box, we've got this Christmas present wrapper, which is the special purpose vehicle, which exists all over the place, and therefore that makes it very readily tradable using electronic systems. And we've also established that we open the box and we see we need to understand what's inside. And you say that if I'm setting up my thing, then I set various rules for the sort of what's inside it. Going back to simple portfolio management, and you say the market has kind of developed in a different way in a sense. But if I'm looking at it in my old profession of being a fund manager, let's say for some crazy reason I get back to be a fund manager, but this time I'm not running global fixed interest fund management, I'm running global trade finance investment management. So I sit there and I have a team of people, and these people analyse the market and analyse the returns and risks and all this kind of stuff, because they're all very clever and they know it. And we have a monthly investment meeting, and people say to me, I really think we should be investing more in Vietnam-Japan trade and less in mobile phones and more in wine and more in sort of America-Canada trade and asset allocation decisions, as it were. That strikes me as a non-trivial thing to do.
Yeah, and it's fundamentally different to many of the other credit type of products. If you want to look up the credit risk of Vietnam, you can find it immediately. There is many rating agencies which will have a very dedicated opinion of how good or bad a country rating is. The same applies with many other bank products, because you always look at the obligor, right, the debtor, and you look at the risk. And the risk usually is assessed based on traditional credit analytics methods, such as kind of incorporating financials, but maybe also interviewing the management, etc. And it's done on a sporadic basis. So it's not like a Moody's, Fitch or S&P would come in and every day kind of like reassess the rating of IBM and would adjust it. So with trade finance, we have a slightly different situation. Trade finance is all about a relationship between a buyer and a seller. And although there might be perfectly reasonable counterparts per se, from a credit perspective, they might actually treat themselves very badly. And that might have something to do with essentially dilution risk. Dilution risk means one party ships the wrong type of goods to the other party ongoingly, right? Maybe this is, you know, operational mistakes, maybe just bad management, but things can happen. And the incorporation of dilution risk, credit risk, and also the potential risk of collusion between two parties, meaning fraud risk, needs to be assessed on a holistic basis. And that leads essentially to the need of a so-called transactional credit scoring. And that's what we provide and allow essentially, or create more transparency than you would get, you know, if you would just kind of like look at old, mostly outdated financial statements.
I see. So again, keeping it simple, TradeTech is creating a marketplace to connect buyers and sellers of trade finance, which is a typical kind of marketplace. In addition, you're doing what not so many marketplaces do, which is giving at the same time a credit rating, shall we say, or a rating or a risk rating or whatever you want to call it, a rating of various transaction pairs, which must be quite a large thing. So, as you say, it's a very complex market. We don't have time to go into it now. There's a zillion different types. How do you have a zillion people assessing each type every day on their spreadsheets?
No, what we do is we apply machine learning on this, and I think it's really kind of like we are riding on the wave of digitalization of the trade finance product, which enables, together with cloud computing, basically enables now to apply large-scale machine learning.
Okay, and that's a whole episode in itself about how you do that, but at least it's people getting a schematic idea on the whiteboard. So it occurs to me there are two issues to wrap up here. The second one is just that with any market, there's liquidity, there's bid-offer spread and all that kind of stuff. We'll come back to that. And obviously, we assume that they're quite wide compared to, I didn't know, US Treasury bond bid-offer spread or FX spreads or something like that. Before we get to that, though, the way that we're talking about this as quite a complex asset class It's an asset class that only banks have understood in the past. I'm a bit out of touch with fund management, but I don't know off the top of my head any fund managers that have got great expertise in trade finance or analysing trade finance or something like this. And a lot of them are conservative. Maybe it's something like hedge funds are more active. They're prepared to put the effort into understanding something if they can get better returns than otherwise, because they're all looking for alpha or whatever the sort of silly thing is called from the 1950s. But just at a very simple level, if trade finance is an attractive asset class, is there not an argument that you set up a subsidiary or someone else does or something that basically, for the sake of argument, does some roughly speaking index tracker fund or something? Yeah, i.e., and I know you're aiming at corporates, not at individuals like me, but let's say you're aiming at individuals. You say, I do all this, Mike. I say, oh, that's great. Do you know what? I'm a bit busy, actually. I don't have a million hours this week to really understand all this kind of stuff. But if you happen to go and set up a sort of a nicer tracker fund that invests in a million types of trade finance and your projected returns are sort of twice LIBOR and the risk is 10% more, I'd buy that. Is there not a case that one of the things you need to do to attract new classes of investor, of corporates, is to make a first product, not the detailed thing that sort of banks are used to doing, but sort of kind of you buy a million of them and sort of the risks kind of net out kind of thing?
Yeah, look, I think the index you mentioned before is a very crucial point for the development of every new market, and it's unavoidable, you know, that this will come. I think it's the wrong thing to build an index on the basis of what banks trade amongst each other, since that's usually very low risk, very high quality, very large corporates. What needs to develop now next is a market where alternative investors, non-bank financial institutions, can access essentially risk which banks maybe don't necessarily want to take, which is a bit, you know, higher risk. And I think that's the nice thing about these alternative investors. You can place any risk with them as long as they understand it and can price it.
Yes.
So there's a market for any type of exposure, but it needs to be transparent.
Okay, so for the sake of argument then, where you are at the moment, which is still early in your journey, you're aiming for clearly, even within corporates, the sophisticated corporate investors. You're not aiming for the sake of argument, I don't want to wish to be rude to Legal & General, but I've got some of their tracker fund. Legal & General probably don't have a whole team of people who understand trade finance in great detail and will buy individual transactions and do SPVs. So you're going for the sophisticated ones. So then very briefly, the other characteristic of markets, as I say, is most simply put, is bid offer spread and what volume can you do. If you're talking about SPVs and me putting my money into SPVs, then the liquidity is presumably relatively low because I create something and it sits there for whatever the term is, I don't know, 1, 3, 5 years or 10 years or something like that. But is the liquidity in a meaningful sense, i.e. bid offer spreads, I can buy something and then sell it again and not lose all my money buying and selling it?
Liquidity, always an important point, of course, but keep in mind these assets are self-liquidating. They are very short-term already. So we can create notes of 3 months, 6 months, you know, 12 months. So it's not as fundamental as in, you know, kind of the infrastructure market where you have 30-year assets and you want to eventually be able after 5 years to sell them. So it's a bit a different situation.
I see. And as I know nothing about most things, if I'm, for the sake of argument, putting my money in a six-month trade finance sort of package of maturity or something, what kind of rates is one getting compared to LIBID, compared to sticking them in a bank deposit?
If you repackage bank exposure, it's anywhere from money market pickup levels, like 50 basis points to maybe 200 basis points area. And then if you go to alternative originators, like factoring companies, anything can basically be achieved well into, you know, the high single digits, low double digit areas.
Great. Okay, so that's covered quite a lot in quite a short time. I'm glad you spent a dozen years or so at Goldman Sachs, because there's plenty of stuff to think about there, and it's very typical of where fintech is going at the moment, which is it's doing rather more complicated things than just rebranding MasterCards with a nice colour. We're really getting sophisticated transactions here where one absolutely needs a decade background in the city to take it forward, and I think by the sound of it, you're not going to be too bored in the coming years. Before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all of you listeners out there. We're all, amazingly enough, and it's one of these things we take for granted, utterly dependent in the modern world on global trade. All of our phones come from somewhere. All of this kit in front of me has come from somewhere. It's all travelled around the world. And one of the unseen things that makes all this happen is trade finance. And it's very interesting that in terms of transparency, this is becoming more transparent. It sounds like it's going to be a little while before individuals actually invest in this, but at some point, I'm sure they will. I'd also like to thank my brand partners, Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. And the smart ones amongst you who are on the case on fintech may have noticed a strategic investment in Smart Pension by JP Morgan recently, which is a great feather in their cap, and I hope finally to persuade Will to come back on the show. So, Christoph, would you like to throw some breadcrumbs on the water and just mention anything about trade tech that we haven't mentioned so far? Of the millions of listeners, who should be checking you out straight away, and what kind of things would you like if anybody happens to have it?
Yeah, any institutional investor, such as a pension fund, insurance company, endowment hedge fund, interested in the trade finance asset class, please reach out. The same, of course, you know, to any bank interested in distributing trade finance. Also, I want to make you aware of the Trade Finance Distribution Initiative, which you can look up on the tradefinancedistribution.com, which is a bank-led and non-bank financial institution-led industry initiative around the trade tech technology, and there will be much more to come. And finally, there's a number of events where you can hear us present. We present this month at the GTR MENA conference in Dubai. We also have the ITFA FinTech Discovery event on the 27th of February in Helsinki. There is the BRC Receivables Finance International Convention in London on March the 6th and the 7th. And finally, there is early April 8th to 11th, the ICC Banking Commission annual meeting, where we also will present.
And how many people are you roughly now across the world in your various offices?
We are 40 people now.
And what are your plans like for the next year or two?
So this year we will reach out for another equity round, and the plan is to scale dramatically. This is an area where we have to develop very complicated B2B systems with very demanding customers, and scale is everything.
And what kind of people will you be hiring over the next year or two?
So we will focus again on the development side, the sales side as well, and where we probably will see the biggest growth is on the AI side.
Good, right. Well, that's certainly a very interesting tour d'horizon. We've covered quite a lot there, and it's very sophisticated stuff. And as I say, absolutely no joking apart, you're not going to be bored. There's plenty of challenges here, but then the more challenges, the more opportunity. And I think, just going back to what I said at the beginning, I quite like this sort of idea that in the future, pension funds wouldn't look like they looked 100 years ago, which was then cash, bonds and equities, but actually would be cash, bonds, equities, litigation finance, trade finance, and a bunch of other stuff, because that's real diversification. It's not that exciting diversifying across French, German and Swiss equity markets. I mean, of course, it's important, blah, 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 but it's not quite as sexy as investing into these other alternative asset classes. So I wish you every success in the future, Christoph, in terms of creating this asset class, in facilitating the market moving forward and facilitating your marketplace and doing the AI. I hope you've got more than 24 hours on your watch every day, because you're going to need them.
Thank you so much, Mike, for having me on the show.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory / non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city with a tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. The mountains and the trees, can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in down between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.